Roscoe slowed up at the town limit. A big Chevy glided onto Margrave's glassy blacktop. The magnolia and dogwood scrub to the left and right was replaced by velvet lawns and ornamental cherries. Those trees with smooth, shiny trunks, like the bark was buffed by hand. In Margrave, it probably was. The Kleiner Foundation was probably paying somebody a handsome salary to do it. The magnolia and dogwood scrub to the left and right was replaced by velvet lawns and ornamental cherries, those trees with smooth, shiny trunks, like the bark was buffed by hand. In Margrave, it probably was. The Kleiner Foundation was probably paying somebody a handsome salary to do it. We passed the neat blocks of stores, all of them empty and complacent, floating on an unearned thousand a week. We jinked around the village green with the statue of Caspar Teal, wafted past the turn down to Roscoe's house with its smashed front door, past the coffee shop, past the benches under the smart awnings, past the parkland where the bars and rooming houses had been back when Margrave was honest, then up to the station house. We pulled off into the lot and parked up. Charlie Hubble's Bentley was still there where I'd left it. Roscoe killed the motor and we sat for a minute. Didn't want to get out. We squeezed hands, her right, my left. A brief good luck gesture. We got out of the car, into battle. The station house was cool and deserted, except for Baker at his desk and Finley on his way out of the Rosewood office and back. He saw us and hurried over. "Teal's back in 10 minutes," he said, "and we got a slight problem." He hustled us back to the office. We went in and he shut the door. "Picard called," he said. "So what's the problem?" I said. "It's the safe house," he said, "where Charlie and the kids are hiding out. That situation has to stay unofficial, right?" "He told me that," I said. "He's out on a limb up there." "Exactly," he said. "That's the problem. He can't staff it. He needs somebody to be up there with Charlie. He's been doing duty himself, but he can't do any more. Can't take any more time out. And he feels it's not appropriate, you know, Charlie being a woman and the little girl and all. Kids terrified of him." He looked over at Roscoe. She saw where the conversation was going.
"He wants me up there?" she asked.
"Just for 24 hours, Finley said. "That's what he's asking for. Will you do it for him?" Roscoe shrugged, smiled.
"Of course I will," she said. "No problem. I can spare a day, as long as you promise to get me back when the fun starts, okay?"
"That's automatic," Finley said. "Fun can't start until we've got the detail, and as soon as we've got the detail, Picard goes official, and he puts his own agents into the safe house. You come back here."
"Okay," Roscoe said. "When do I go?"
"Right now," Finley said. "He'll be here any minute." She grinned at him.
"So you already figured I'd agree to it?" she said.
He grinned back at her. "Like I told Reacher," he said. "You're the best we got." She and I went back through the squad room and out through the glass doors. Roscoe took her valise out of the Chevy and set it on the curb.
"See you tomorrow, I guess," she said.
"You gonna be okay?" I asked her.
"Sure," she said. "I'm gonna be fine. Can't get much safer than an FBI safe house, right? But I'm gonna miss you, Reacher. I didn't figure to spend time apart just yet."
I squeezed her hand. She kissed me on the cheek, just stretched up for a quick peck. Finley pushed the station house door open. I heard the suck of the rubber seal. He stuck his head out and called over to Roscoe. "You better give Picard an update, okay?" he said. Roscoe nodded to him. Then we stood waiting in the sun. Didn't have to wait long. Picard's blue sedan squealed into the lot within a couple of minutes, bounced to a stop right next to us. The big guy folded himself out of the seat and stood up, just about blotted out the sun. "I appreciate this, Roscoe," he said to her. "You're really helping me out."
"No problem," she said. "You're helping us out, right? Where is this place I'm going?"
Picard grinned a harassed grin, nodded toward me.
I can't say where it is, he told her. Not in front of civilians, right? I'm way out of line already, and I'm going to have to ask you not to tell him afterward, okay? And Reacher, don't you press her about it, or Charlie, okay?
Okay, I said. I wouldn't press her about it. She'd tell me anyway.
Good, Picard said.
He nodded a busy goodbye and picked up Roscoe's bag, threw it onto his rear seat. Then the two of them got into the blue sedan and drove off. Nosed out of the lot and headed north. I waved after them. Then the car was lost to sight. Chapter 23.
Details. Evidence gathering. Surveillance. It's the basis of everything. You've got to settle down and watch long enough and hard enough to get what you need. While Roscoe made cups of coffee for Charlie Hubble and Finley sat in the Rosewood office, I was going to have to watch the warehouse operation. Long enough and hard enough until I got a feel for exactly how they did it. It could take me a full 24 hours. Could be Roscoe would get back before I did. I got in the Bentley and cruised up the 14 miles to the Cloverleaf. Slowed down as I passed the warehouses. I needed to scout out a vantage point. The northbound on-ramp dived under the southbound off-ramp. There was a kind of low overpass. Short, wide concrete pillars hoisted the road overhead. I figured the thing to do would be to hole up behind one of those pillars. I would be well hidden in the gloom, and the slight elevation would give me a good view of the whole warehouse area. That was my spot. I accelerated the Bentley up the ramp and carried on north to Atlanta. Took an hour. I was picking up a rough idea of the geography. I wanted the low-rent shopping area, and I found it easily enough. Saw the sort of street I wanted. Automobile customizers, pool table wholesalers, repossessed office furniture. I parked on the street in front of Storefront Mission. Opposite me were two survival shops. I picked the left-hand one and went in. The door worked a bell. The guy at the counter looked up. He was the usual type of guy. White man, black beard, camouflage fatigues, boots. He had a huge gold hoop in one ear. Looked like some kind of a pirate. He might have been a veteran. Might just have wanted to be one. He nodded to me. He had the stuff I needed. I picked up olive fatigue pants and a shirt. Found a camouflage jacket big enough to fit. Looked at the pockets carefully. I had to get the Desert Eagle in there. Then I found a water canteen and some decent field glasses. Humped the whole lot over to the cash desk and piled it up. Pulled out my wad of hundreds. The guy with the beard looked at me. I could use a blackjack, I said. He looked at me and looked at my wad of hundreds. Then he ducked down and hoisted a box up. Looked heavy. I chose a fat sap about 9 inches long. It was a leather tube taped at one end for a grip, built around a plumber's spring. The thing they put inside pipes before they bend them. It was packed around with lead shot. An efficient weapon. I nodded, paid for everything, and left. The bell rang again as I pushed open the door. I moved the Bentley along 100 yards and parked up in front of the first automobile shop I saw advertising window tinting. Leaned on the horn and got out to meet the guy coming out of the door. "Can you put tints on this for me?" I asked him.
"On this thing?" he said. "Sure I can. I can put tints on anything."
"How long?" I said. The guy stepped up to the car and ran his finger down the silky coachwork.
"Thing like this, you want a first-rate job," he said. "Take me, couple of days, maybe three."
"How much?" I said. He carried on feeling the paint and sucked air in through his teeth like all car guys do when you ask them how much.
Couple of hundred, he said. "That's for a first-rate job, and you don't want anything less on a thing like this."
"I'll give you $250, I said. "That's for a better than first-rate job, and you loan me a car the 2 or 3 days it's going to take you to do it, okay?" The guy sucked in some more air and then slapped lightly on the Bentley's hood.
"It's a done deal, my friend," he said.
I took the Bentley key off Charlie's ring and exchanged it for an 8-year-old Cadillac the color of an old avocado pear. It seemed to drive pretty well, and it was about as anonymous as you could hope to get.
The Bentley was a lovely automobile, but it was not what I needed if the surveillance went mobile. It was about as distinctive as the most distinctive thing you could ever think of. I cleared the southern rim of the city and stopped at a gas station, brimmed the old Cadillac's big tank, and bought candy bars and nuts and bottles of water. Then I used their toilet cubicle to get changed. I put on the military surplus gear and threw my old stuff into the towel bin, went back out to the car, put the Desert Eagle in the long inside pocket of my new jacket, cocked and locked, poured the spare bullets into the outside top pocket. Morrison's switchblade was in the left side pocket, and I put the blackjack in the right. I shared the nuts and the candy bars around the other pockets, poured a bottle of water into the canteen, and went to work. It took me another hour to get back to Margrave. I drove the old Cadillac right around the cloverleaf, up the on-ramp again, heading north. Backed up about 100 yards along the shoulder and stopped right in the no-man's land between the off-ramp and the on-ramp, where nobody would pass either leaving or joining the highway. Nobody would see the car except people shooting right past Margrave, and they wouldn't care. I popped the hood and propped it open, locked up the car and left it like that. It made it invisible, just a broken-down old sedan on the shoulder, a sight so ordinary you don't see it. Then I climbed over the low concrete wall at the edge of the shoulder, scrambled down the high bank, ran south and sprinted across the on-ramp, carried on running for the shelter of the low overpass. I ran under the width of the highway to the other side and holed up behind a broad pillar. Over my head, the trucks coming off the highway rumbled around to the old county road. Then they ground their gears and branched right for the warehouses. I settled back and got comfortable behind the pillar. I had a pretty good vantage point, maybe 200 yards distant, maybe 30 feet of elevation. The whole place was laid out below me like a diagram. The field glasses I'd bought were clear and powerful. There were actually 4 separate warehouses, all identical, built in a tight line, running away from me at an oblique angle. The whole area was ringed by a serious fence, plenty of razor wire at the top. Each of the 4 compounds had its own inner fence. Each inner fence had its own gate. The outer fence held the main gate, fronting onto the road. The whole place was swarming with activity. The first compound was totally innocent. The big roller door stood open. I could see local farm trucks rattling in and out. People were loading and unloading in plain view. Sturdy burlap sacks bulging with something or other. Maybe produce, maybe seed or fertilizer, whatever farmers use, I had no idea. But there was nothing secret, nothing hidden. All the trucks were local, Georgia plates on all of them, no out-of-state vehicles, nothing big enough to roll south to north along the height of the nation. The first compound was clean, no doubt about that. Same went for the second and third. Their gates stood open, their doors were up. All their activity was a cheerful swarm on their forecourts. Nothing secret, all in plain view. Different types of trucks, but all local. Couldn't see what they were hauling. Wholesale stuff for the little country stores, maybe. Possibly manufactured goods going somewhere. Some kind of oil drums in the third shed, but nothing to get excited about. The fourth warehouse was the one I was looking for. The one at the end of the row. No doubt about it. It was a smart location. Made a lot of sense. It was screened by the chaos on the first 3 forecourts, but because it was the last in line, none of the local farmers or merchants would ever need to pass it by. Nobody would get a look at it. A smart location. It was definitely the one. Beyond it, maybe 75 yards away in a field, was the blasted tree. The one Roscoe had picked out of the photograph of Stoller and Hubble and the yellow truck. A camera on the forecourt would pick up the tree just beyond the far corner of the structure. I could see that. This was the place. No doubt about it. The big roller door across the front was closed. The gate was closed. There were 2 gatemen hanging around on the forecourt. Even from 200 yards, the field glasses picked up their alert glances and the wary tension in their walks. Some kind of a security role. I watched them for a while. They strode around, but nothing was happening. So I shifted around to watch the road, waited for a truck
bound for the fourth compound. It was a good, long wait. I was uptight about the time ticking away, so I sang to myself. I went through every version of Rambling on My Mind that I knew. Everybody has a version. It's always listed as a traditional song. Nobody knows whose it was. Nobody knows where it came from. Probably from way back in the Delta. It's a song for people who can't stay around, even though maybe there's a good reason to. People like me. I'd been around Margrave practically a week. Longest I'd ever stayed anywhere voluntarily. I should stay forever. With Roscoe, because she was good for me. I was beginning to imagine a future with her. It felt good. But there were going to be problems. When Kleiner's dirty money was taken out, the whole town was going to fall apart. There wouldn't be any place left to stay around in. And I had to wander. Like the song I was singing in my head, I had to ramble. A traditional song. A song that could have been written for me. In my heart, I believed Blind Blake had made it up. He had wandered. He had walked right by this place when the concrete pillars were old shade trees. 60 years ago, he had walked down the road I was watching, maybe singing the song I was singing. Joe and I used to sing that old song. We'd sing it as an ironic comment on Army family life. We'd stumble off a plane somewhere and ride to an airless, empty base house. 20 minutes after moving in, we'd start up singing that song, like we'd been there long enough and we were ready to move on again. So I leaned back on the concrete pillar and sang it for him, as well as for me. Took me 35 minutes to run through every version of that old song, once for me and once for Joe. During that time, I saw maybe a half dozen trucks pull into the warehouse approach. All local guys, all little dusty Georgia trucks. Nothing with long-haul grime blasted all over it. Nothing headed for the end building. I sang softly for 35 minutes and picked up no information at all. But I did get some applause. I finished the last song and heard a slow, ironic hand clap coming out of the darkness behind me. I whipped around the broad concrete pillar and stared into the gloom. The clapping stopped, and I heard a shuffling sound. Picked up the vague shape of a man crawling toward me. The shape firmed up, some kind of a hobo. Long, gray, matted hair and layers of heavy clothing. Bright eyes burning in a seamed and dirty face. The guy stopped out of reach. "Who the hell are you?" I asked him. He swiped his curtain of hair aside and grinned at me.
"Who the hell are you?" he said. "Coming to my place and bawling like that?"
"This is your place," I said. "You live under here?" He settled on his haunches and shrugged at me.
"Temporarily," he said.
"Been here a month.
You got a problem with that?"
I shook my head. I had no problem with that. A guy had to live somewhere. "Sorry to disturb you," I said. "I'll be out of here by tonight." His smell was drifting over to me. Wasn't pleasant. This guy smelled like he'd been on the road all his life.
"Stay as long as you like," he said. "We just decided to move on. We're vacating the premises."
"We?" I said. "There's somebody else here?" The guy looked at me oddly, turned and pointed to the air beside him. There was nobody there. My eyes had adjusted to the gloom. I could see all the way back to the concrete cantilever under the elevated road. Just empty space.
"My family," he said. "We're pleased to meet you, but we got to go. Time to move on."
He reached behind him and dragged a canvas kit bag out of the gloom. Army issue. There was a faint stencil on it. PFC something with a serial number and a unit designation. He pulled it up close and shuffled away.
"Wait up," I said. "Were you here last week? Thursday?"
The guy stopped and half turned back.
"Been here a month," he said. "Didn't see anything last Thursday."
I looked at him and his kit bag. A soldier. Soldiers don't volunteer anything. Their basic rule. So I eased off the concrete and pulled a candy bar out of my pocket. Wrapped it in a $100 bill, tossed it over to him. He caught it and put it in his coat, nodded to me silently.